The Gary Knoll Show, weekdays at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, we're going to give you the latest on healing the brain naturally, what vitamin C can do to help you if you have tumors in the body. Also, guess which corporation was voted the most evil corporation of the year by Natural News readers, and there are a lot of them, I'll tell you that. I had someone this morning stop me on the street and was asking me about a program I had done a long time ago, several years ago, where I equated our footprint, meaning each day of our lives, we create a footprint based upon what we eat and wear, drive, the materials we use in our home, apartments, and we rarely consider, are these finite? In other words, is there a limited amount of the natural resources, or are these infinite? We can use them forever. Are they self-replenishing or not? And the person said, I remember is I was sitting in my car, I couldn't write anything down, and the numbers were just staggering. Could you just give us an example? Now this person has moved from New York to where they are now. They're in Nevada. And they said they had to go there because that's where their work took them. But there, people do not pay attention to water, but they should because they're running out of water. So I said, yes, on my program today, time permitting, I will talk about humanity's growing impact on the world's fresh water, not for something far off in the future, but absolutely right now, as we're speaking today, and what we can expect in the next 3 years. But it's more than anything, it's a positive message to show you that you can lower the consumption of water producing and save water by making some simple adjustments in your life. I'll be sharing information from Post Carbon Institute and Sandra Postel on that. I will also today, if time permits, share the 12 tipping points in our environment and why it's important that we understand that. But today I'm going to begin our program in reverse order. Normally it's health and healing, nutrition, and then the environment. Then we go to our guests and social issues. But my guest has to go on a trip. In fact, is going to go right after his interview. And so I wanted Dr. Michael Hudson to be first on so he can share his thoughts and not miss his plane. We're going to talk about something the average American knows is happening but doesn't know why it's important for them to understand this. Professor Michael Hudson is one of our nation's leading progressive minds. He specializes in economics, Wall Street financial analysis. He is currently the president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends and the chief economic policy advisor for countries around the world, and he was instrumental in Iceland's maneuvering, and that's good, but you hear nothing about that. That's not even discussed in the United States about, gee whiz, why can't Greece do what Iceland did and just say, no, we are not going to give the banks all this money and at the same time destroy our quality of life and be indebted forever. So behind the scenes around the world, you'll find Michael Hudson providing people with a more humanistic way of dealing with their crisis. He is also the author of Global Fracture, The New International Economic Order. Following Michael Hudson today will be a Washington and New York insider. She is Eve Smith, founder of the influential financial blog NakedCapitalism.com and the author of Econ, How Unenlightened Self-Interest Undermined Democracy and Corrupted Capitalism, which, by the way, is a very timely and important investigation into how the symptoms associated with our economic crisis take precedence over the more important cause for economic collapse, which resides in the unquestioned role of economists as policymakers. And for over 30 years, Eve has been a Wall Street veteran at the top of the food chain down there, working with Goldman Sachs and a major corporate financial advisors. Her articles have appeared in the New York Times, Slate, and Christian Monitor. To Eve, I'm going to ask her to explain in lay language why the $26 billion bailout, and that's really what it is, meaning all the problems of all the banks and lending companies that gave us fraudulent loans, liar loans, robo-signing, how all that is sanitized when they give $26 billion over, and a tiny amount of that goes to actually some homeowners, tiny, why we should not have given them that, and why it may be, and it may, I'm going to ask her, may be that we end up having to pay for that also, based on language that's in that settlement. And what we could learn if we simply allowed the too big to fails to fail. Take them out of business. I am going to ask her about this, what I consider a perverse myth, that we must constantly be bailing out the large financial institutions, because if we didn't and they closed or went out of business, became insolvent, it would crash the entire world economy. I do not believe that, because none of these major institutions, not one of these major institutions, is responsible for creating the finance, the capital, to allow the majority of Americans to have a quality of life. They have their own source of finance, and it is not about building factories or giving loans to small business people. So we're going to talk about that. I think it's important we discuss this. So that's our program. Let's go now to my first guest, Dr. Michael Hudson. Nice to have you back with us.
Thank you very much, Gary.
I'd like to keep us focused on Greece, but in greater detail, because I have friends who live in Greece. In fact, I just had a meeting with a person who's a top academic from Greece, and he has spent the last 2 months traveling the country, just getting the feel on the ground. Here's what he says, and then I'll turn this over to you. He is telling me that, yes, it was a foregone conclusion that whatever financial policies the Parliament put through, because they were all corporate insiders, that no one would really be able to challenge them. But once this $171 billion of money was approved by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and bondholders, given to Greece, A, he said the majority of that money would never go to Greece. It would go back to the banks. I'd like for you to address that in a moment. B, he said that they're going to ask for 22% reduction in the minimum wage. They're going to ask for another 100,000 federal employees to be let go. They're going to raise the retirement rate. But he said the real cherry for a lot of these corporations that are behind this bailout is privatizing. He says they're going to privatize all of the roads, the sewer system, the water system, the electrical system, the gas system, food distribution, the islands, the tourist islands, and about 100 other projects in Greece will now be privatized. All of these things the average person in Greece can now take for granted. No one has to pay extra to flush their toilet or to take a shower. He said now that's all going to change. He said so there is no opportunity for the Greeks to reboot their economy if they have this enormous burden, even though it's going to go from 171% of their gross domestic product to 121, but that's in 10 years. He said this is one of the biggest thefts in history. He said, however, this is my final point. He says, Gary, the unions are everywhere demanding that this government has to go, and it'll either go peacefully or by violence. The Greek people will not, under any circumstance, tolerate this. He said, if you think that what you are seeing now in Syria or what you saw in Lebanon is bad, you have no idea what kind of temperament that the Greek people have and how they're despising bankers, the United States bankers, the United States Congress, and everyone else who has participated in this. He said it's going to hit the fan in the next 6 months, and it's going to be down, dirty, and violent. Now, that's what he says. He can be completely wrong. He could be, you know, thinking this is going to happen, but it doesn't. take us through what is happening in Greece and why, if we're at all conscientious, we should pay attention, because what's going on in Greece will impact us.
Well, first of all, what your friend has said about Greece is exactly what the Financial Times of London has been reporting on the front page every single day for the last few weeks. So this is not just one person's view. This is actually what's happening. And in fact, from last Friday over the weekend, the agreement that the EU made with the politicians in Greece, they're not elected politicians, by the way. They're called technocrats, as if this is somehow scientific. A technocrat is a lobbyist for the banks. So the banks have appointed the technocrats in charge of Greece. You remember that the former Prime Minister Papandreou had wanted to have a referendum, as they had in Iceland, over whether to pay. And Angela Merkel and the others said, no, if you have a referendum, no democracy would ever vote for this kind of a thing. We've got to appoint our own leaders and simply buy off the other Greek leaders. The European Union is taking even more of a pro-bank position than the IMF, which is unheard of in history, and has insisted that whatever money they give is given not to the Greek government at all, but to the European Central Bank to dispose of and pay the bondholders. So the bailout of Greece is really a payment of credit by the European Central Bank to the bondholders of the Greek bonds to pay for the debts that are run up ever since the colonels military regime, the debts that are run up by untaxing wealth, by not taxing real estate, by not taxing the ship owners, by not taxing the wealthy. So I think you can look at Greece as a dress rehearsal for what's happening in the United States. And it's a dress rehearsal for an experiment to say, how much can we reduce wages without the population fighting back? Well, actually, the Greek population, as your friend says, is fighting back, and they're demonstrating in the streets to say, look, you can buy off the government policy leaders, the ruling party, the socialists. In Europe, socialist means ultra-right wing of the political spectrum, not left wing as here. You can buy off the socialists, and they now have only an 8% approval rating, but we're demonstrating so that you can know that when we do elect our own parties, not the coalition politicians you're dealing with, but our parties, the first thing we're going to do is repudiate the debt and deprivatize everything. Well, over the weekend, the Germans and the Europeans said, wait a minute, I can see that we can't trust Greece. Greece will have to promise in advance exactly what it's going to privatize. And as your friend said, they want the water and sewer systems. They want the oil rights off the islands. They want the tourist sites. They want everything in the public domain. And what this means is that finance today is achieving what a thousand years ago, the military conquest of Europe, the Viking invasions, the Norman invasion of England, and the European colonization of Latin America achieved by force. In the past, you needed an army to grab all of these public assets. But today they're trying to do it without an army, simply by finance. And in fact, almost all of the net Greek debt that is being bailed out has been used to buy German submarines, French arms, and the military. So many of the Greeks I know say, okay, give them back the military armaments. Greece is one of the most heavily militarized countries in the world, ever since the colonels, to keep the military backing the democracy. All they have to do is give back the arms that they bought, and the budget will be in balance. But instead, they're using the debt crisis for the same thing that Mr. Obama is using the debt crisis here in the United States. They're saying, because we've untaxed the rich people, you have to raise taxes on labor, and you have to lower the wages. So both the Greeks and the American government want to lower wage levels and living standards here by about 30%. What they don't know is whether there's going to be as much of a response here as there is in Greece. You've seen the Occupy Wall Street movement arise by saying the system is unfair. We're not going to take it. But are they willing to fight to the extent that they fought in Greece, much like Arab Spring and much like Syria and the other countries? And the answer is you don't know how much you can push down a population until they begin to fight back. And that's the experiment in Greece. It was the experiment in Iceland. And it's going to be the experiment in the United States after this year's November elections.
Two more quick questions. Last weekend, you had one of the largest demonstrations in Spain's history with a massive amount of people going to the streets. It wasn't covered at all in the United States media. And Spain is a much larger economy than Greece, has very high unemployment levels, great numbers when it comes to home foreclosures. They're insolvent as a country, and yet they're also being told if you want more money, you have to go through additional austerity. Where are any of these countries supposed to regrow their economy if all they're doing is being put into a severe austerity program? It's like telling someone you're 100 pounds, now we're going to take you down to 50 to lose weight by starving you. I don't see how any of the countries that are in trouble now are going to rebalance their country by having enormous debts that they're going to give to the banks, to give to the bondholders and all these speculators, instead of putting it back into supporting their own economies.
Well, you're quite right, Gary. No country has ever been able to repay its debts by imposing austerity. When there's austerity and there are layoffs and unemployment and falling wages, people are even less able to pay the debts. There are more defaults on property, and so the government deficit goes up. So what people say is the cover story to help the economy really isn't the real story at all. These technocrats are basically giving an excuse for the creditor countries to come in and grab the assets. They know that Spain can't pay back. And by the way, the Spanish demonstrators call themselves the indignant ones. They've done what the Occupy Wall Street people have done here in saying the system is unfair. What they've done is act as a catalyst. Say the problem isn't simply that austerity makes it impossible to pay the debts. The fact is that the system itself, as it's turned away from industrial capitalism into finance capitalism, the system is wrong. And that's why neither the Spaniards nor the American Occupy Wall Street people are coming out with a neat little fix-it thing, such as the Obama administration are doing. And Eve Smith is certainly going to talk to you about the banks, the notorious bank giveaway. The whole idea is a pretense to make the population acquiesce in this property grab that's being done simply by bankers without an armed occupation. And the question is, can they do it without an army? It took an army for the French to conquer England, not a big army under the Conqueror in 1066, but they conquered it. Not a big army for Pizarro in Peru or the conquest of Mexico. In every computer model, the Spaniards lost to Mexico and Peru, and yet they won. So in every computer model today, you'd think that under a democracy, the people would fight back and say, look, we're not going to give up all our property to you. You're not going to push in neoliberals and have a cut the taxes on real estate, cut the taxes on the rich, and then say there's a deficit, and now wages have to be lowered to make up the debts that you guys have made reckless loans after giving us bad advice and a neoliberal program that doesn't work. How are populations going to say no without a violent response, such as you're seeing in Greece, or a general strike, such as you're seeing in Spain? The only solution the Spanish can come up with is, well, we're not going to work, and we're going to shut down the economy rather than let you grab it.
Two final quick issues. Are you aware that today Obama is proposing to sign legislation that would drop all corporate income tax to 24% from 35%?
I thought that had to be passed by Congress before that happened.
It is, but it's the proposal.
Uh-huh. Yes, I am aware that Mr. Obama isn't really a president in the sense that George Washington or Abraham Lincoln were. The president of America today, whoever he is, really is in the position of a lawyer arguing for his clients, and the clients are the campaign contributors. And Mr. Obama's main campaign contributors are Wall Street, and he's in the position of a lawyer trying to convince the jury, in this case the voters, that what he's doing really is fair instead of a ripoff. And it's the American way that even a criminal class or a criminogenic financial class has the right to have their own lawyer. That's how the courts work. And Mr. Obama is basically the lawyer for the Wall Street people in trying to get this kind of a ripoff. The idea, Mr. Obama's intention is to run the U.S. Much further into debt so that then he can call upon the IMF to say, you have to lower wages by 30% and you have to impose on America the same kind of austerity in Greece. And because the Republicans and the Democrats are in agreement with their campaign contributors, we don't expect you Americans to fight back anywhere near like the Greeks are doing, or even be indignant by Spain. We're giving you a choice this November to vote yes, yes please, or yes thank you if there's a third party candidate. And that's basically the plan. It's almost like it's orchestrated.
My final question for you, it has a few parts. First, do you see the dollar maintaining its position for the next 5 years as the reserve currency? Secondly, do you see that either Ireland, Portugal, or Spain are likely to follow with massive protests and simply reject the idea of giving any more bailouts? Last part of this, do you think that any of this would be happening in Europe right now if the Federal Reserve had not given $16.1 trillion that we know of, there may be more we don't know of, in 0.2 interest loans to European banks? In fact, many of them who are playing in this area, plus Wall Street firms that are playing with derivatives and credit default swaps, if they weren't guaranteed that they have a backstop, because my sources are telling me that if no matter what happens, the Federal Reserve is going to bail out the European Central Bank, or it could bail out itself by printing money much like the Federal Reserve. But there's not going to be a bad day ahead once this goes through because of the Federal Reserve's backstopping all of the bad things that could happen, and hence the American people. Your thoughts?
That looks like what's happening. First of all, about the balance, the U.S. dollar. Other central banks around the world hold dollars because the United States is running a balance of payments deficit. Now, while Mr. Obama talks about China and Asian, the fact is that for most of the years since 1950, since the Korean War broke out, the entire U.S. balance of payments deficit is military spending. So the dollars that America spends in its 80 or so military bases around the world, 800, in Iran, in Iraq, and everywhere else, these are the dollars that are ending up in foreign central banks. So that's what's prompted the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, to say, we don't want a system where our foreign exchange central bank reserves are the embodiment of U.S. foreign military spending. We want to demilitarize the international financial system by moving away from the dollar. That's what my book Super Imperialism is about, and that's what Mr. Putin in Russia has been giving speeches about recently. The question is, will the dollar continue to survive against the euro? Well, it's a question of which country is less weak. The Federal Reserve, as you pointed out, sent Mr. Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, over to Europe and told Europe Greece was about to default and write down the debts. And the Greek banks were not sad about this, because the Greek banks, the French banks, and the other bondholders all had taken out default insurance largely with the American banks, with Citibank, Chase. Chase, Manhattan, Bank of America, Mr. Geithner came over and said, wait a minute, our banks have all gambled that the Greek government will pay. If we lose the gamble, we're going to go under. So I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to arrange the Federal Reserve to give you a line of credit, and the line of credit will be that we will lend you the money to lend to Greece so that it can pay the debt, so that our banks that have made the bet won't have to gamble. And we know that, as the Financial Times has pointed out, we know that in a year or less, Greece is going to default again. But by that time, the U.S. banks can get rid of all of their guarantees. The default guarantees will expire, and that means that the European banks and the Greek people will bear the cost of default, not the American banks. So this is a manipulation. Now, the German bankers I talked to said that they threw Mr. Geithner out of the meetings, and however, Mrs. Merkel and the other European leaders all knuckled under to the United States and said, whatever you want. So as long as the United States controls the foreign political leaders, the dollar's going to remain the world currency, because the threat is, well, if you don't support the dollar, we will put all of our American money and our National Institute for Democracy and all that, we'll back other leaders besides you, and we'll get rid of you. So there's a fear of American covert operations away from all of this. And basically, you can look at what's happening as a maneuverability over who is going to take the loss from the bad debts. Will it be the American banks that have bet against default, or will it be the European banks, or will it be the European taxpayers and workers?
Okay, I appreciate you taking your time this morning before your trip to share these insights with us. Thanks a lot, Michael Hudson.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Super Imperialism and Global Fracture, the two books. My next guest is standing by, and we're going to go over, I'd already introduced you earlier, to Eve Smith. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks so much, Gary.
For you, I would like a different direction, if we would, please. I'm very concerned. And let me share my larger concern, and then take any part of what I'm going to share and break it into pieces and give us your answer. I'm concerned that there have been multiple opportunities for the President of the United States and Congress to offer a moratorium on home foreclosures, to at least keep people in their home for 3 years. I also believe that the banks and the White House could have gone public and said, look, let's bring the cost of these mortgages down to the value of the property, and therefore nobody would be underwater. For those who still can't afford it, let's charge them rent instead of paying high interest rates and sometimes interest only. In other words, there's a lot that could have been done to have protected the $14 trillion in home equity that people lost and are now even more going to lose. But instead, at every turn, the Congress, the White House, has continued to side exclusively with the needs and desires of the Wall Street banks and other banks. And then the final tipping was when, for a $26 billion tab, a group of banks, and that's a small amount per bank, could get free of any liability. And yet the crimes they committed were massive. One of the largest and massive crimes in American history, corporate crime. And I'm wondering, why didn't the government go ahead and just say, no, let's find out what's really behind all of this and hold these people accountable? You and I would be held accountable for minor indiscretions. Why are they allowed to commit such massive amounts of crime? And then I'm told, and I don't know if this is true or not, and I will ask you your opinion, that even that $26 billion, they may not end up paying themselves, but rather they end up with using part of the government program that was already there to assist homeowners who were in trouble, that they could use that money. So then that means that they've gotten away 100% with a crime against all of us, and now we can't do anything about it. So I would like for you to go through this and make sense of it for us.
Well, one of the issues here is that the system is that we now have for doing loans is has become very complex because of a process called securitization. And that has somewhat restricted the options that the government could take in a best-case scenario. I'm not saying that as an excuse. I'm saying that this is one of the reasons why there aren't the kind of Gordian knot solution we'd like to think that there are. I mean, one of the best things that the administration could have done would have been to pass something called bankruptcy cramdowns to push that kind of initiative. When people, if people are in financial trouble, they can declare bankruptcy, and then the value of the mortgages would have been written down to the current value of their house. That would have created a lot of bargaining leverage for borrowers, and I think we would have seen the banks being forced to negotiate a lot of these loans when they're not. But the current process isn't that the banks own the loans in most cases. You know, in the old-fashioned days of a George Bailey Bank, you would go to the bank, and the person that you dealt with to get your mortgage would also be the person that kept your mortgage. That's not true in the overwhelming majority of cases. In the overwhelming majority of cases, the loans are taken and they go through a series of parties, and that's designed that way for legal reasons. It's not just because there were a lot of middlemen. This was to help protect the banks and help protect the investors. But they would wind up in a legal box called a trust, and then the cash flows from that trust would be distributed to different types of investors. It turns out that that system is very has got incentives in it for banks not to modify loans. In the old days, when a borrower got in trouble, a home borrower, the first thing a bank would think about is, gee, should I foreclose or should I keep the borrower in the home? And in the overwhelming majority of cases, it made more sense to keep the borrower in the home. So that's the first part. In terms of foreclosure moratorium, this is actually state law. This is why we had to have state attorney generals involved in this process. And it isn't clear that it would be within the federal government's power to impose a foreclosure moratorium nationally. But in terms of who this helps, the banks still have a tremendous amount of liability because even though many of the originators are dead, the banks still, for example, made promises about the quality of the loans that, in as we know, in many cases weren't true to the investors. They also continue to engage in abusive practices in how they service the loans. There are many stories of how, and again, because nobody's done an investigation, we don't know how pervasive it is, but it's more common than the banks and the media would lead you to believe. In many cases, the borrower, for example, banks will apply interest payments and principal payments impermissibly. They're supposed to apply the payments that borrowers send to interest and principal first and then take fees out. For example, if there's a late fee or if the banks have been documented to just apply late fees even when the borrower paid on time. But what happens is they'll apply the late fee first, which makes the payment short and then creates future late payments. So the way the loans are serviced are close to a scam, and that ultimately hurts, and there are games they're playing that hurt the investors as well. It's not as if they're abusing the borrowers. They're also abusing the investors. To your point about the settlement being a release of all liability, it isn't a release of all liability, but it's a release of the liability that is easiest for the state attorneys general and the federal government to prove that the banks have been forging documents and creating phony documents in foreclosures, getting that, if anybody were to prosecute that seriously, they'd be able to find out a lot of other things that the banks have been done that would then lead to additional types of litigation. In theory, the states and the federal government can pursue the banks, for example, for criminal liability. But as we've seen, both the head of the enforcement for the Securities and Exchange Commission and people at the DOJ say, oh, it's so hard to prosecute people criminally. Oh, it's really too difficult. Which, of course, implies that they're not going to do that. It's pretty clear they have no will to do that except for low-level people. They're perfectly happy to go after low-level people because it makes it look like they're being tough, but they're really not willing to go after anybody very senior because that would indict the integrity of the entire system. So as a consequence, it's even though the banks, even though the release of liability actually doesn't cover everything, it appears to have covered most of what the banks are worried about and seriously worried about. And what it doesn't cover, we've got all these winks and nods that the authorities probably aren't going to go after that. In terms of the structure of the bailout, people keep talking about the fact that it's $25 or $26 billion. That's the number the administration keeps pushing. In fact, a very small portion of that is in actual hard cash. The rest of it is various forms of credit for things that the banks are supposed to do. For example, they're getting $10 billion of credit for modifying mortgages and $7 billion of credit for things like short sales and relief for blighted areas. It's pretty certain for the principal modification that the banks are going to do that not from the mortgages they own, but from other mortgages other people own, that investors own. In fact, the administration was saying they expected 85% of the modifications to come from other mortgages, and then they began walking that back when investors woke up and said, oh, hey, wait a second, we don't like that. And remember, even though we talk about investors like they're rich people, in fact, the investors in mortgages are to a significant degree ordinary Americans. You have people's pension funds, to the extent there are pension funds left. There, you know, a lot of the union pension funds hold mortgage-backed securities. Insurance companies hold mortgage-backed securities, which means that if they suffer losses, people are going to pay higher insurance rates. And a lot of 401ks have options in the 401k plans that are bond funds that, again, invest in mortgage-backed securities. So the average American is exposed to losses on the bonds. And the other part is that the banks will be able to use a program the government implemented called HAMP to implement some of these modifications.
The Home Affordable
Mortgage Program, right.
Modification plan.
And the banks get incentive payments for successful modifications. So here, the whole idea of this settlement was that it was supposed to be a punishment for the banks, but what kind of punishment is it if the banks get taxpayer incentives to implement the modifications? That money, the Obamas just tripled the incentives under that. So that should have been more than sufficient for the banks to do what they were supposed to do anyhow.
A couple of final questions here. I'm concerned where Lloyd Blankfein,
Blankfein,
and others are suggesting it's now a great time to be purchasing homes because the value, without telling people the banks are sitting on 4.5 million homes that have been foreclosed on. If those were considered as a part of the value of the home market right now would drop by another 20 to 30%, and they're not being honest. Also, my final question for you is, I've looked very carefully at the percentage of our gross domestic product that comes from the financial industries. Then I did an analysis of where the money from the financial industry comes from. How do they actually make their money? And I did a series of spreadsheets, and I then had to shake my head and say, why didn't we allow the major banks and Wall Street firms to go through a structured bankruptcy to write off their debts and be done with them once and for all, bring in new ownership, and if people wish to recapitalize or regrow those are fine, but continuing to allow trillions of dollars to go to Citigroup and the other major banks, and then we think that they're okay when they haven't shown us their full capacity for debt, meaning how much debt do they really have, what positions have they taken. I know five banks are at $24 trillion in credit default swaps, so as Michael said, if that goes bad over there, who's supposed to pay that $24 trillion? The American public? Well, look at AIG. Didn't we give Goldman Sachs, who didn't lose a nickel, didn't we give them $12 billion out of AIG, which is taxpayer money? That was a part of this. So I'm saying, let's let the big companies go broke through structured bankruptcy. Let's stop pumping taxpayer money into these banks, because we're not helping the taxpayer. And if no other reason than just some sense of equality, if you're going to help every small business person that would be holding people at good jobs in their neighborhoods, if you gave them a break, but you're not giving them a break. And if you were to help some of the companies that could stay in the United States, if there was some support for them, but there is no support. But when it comes to the banks on Wall Street, there's no amount of money that they can't ask for. And then we find out how much it really was, $16 trillion. And I'm very concerned. I think this is only going to get worse. And then just a few weeks ago, President Obama said no more bailouts for the too big to fail. That's what he said. It's a matter of record. Well, guess what? Now they're planning a quantitative easing number three. So he's right back to doing what he's doing. He's going to give more money out. Does this ever end? Is there any sanity that's capable of being brought to bear on these issues? Your final thoughts, please.
Okay, well, the two things. One is yes, I agree with all your concerns about the way that the administration and a lot of the banking analysts are trying to sell the idea that housing has bottomed. Now, housing is always local, so there could very well be some markets where the housing prices have declined enough and the local economy is sound enough that housing is indeed a bargain. So I don't want to suggest that everywhere housing still has more risk to the downside. But certainly the point you raised is absolutely correct. All these analysts are talking about, oh, gee, housing inventories are down. Oh, gee, prices, seem to be moving up a little. Oh, gee, there are more new housing starts. Well, they forget about the fact that we've had, since the robo-signing scandal, the banks have dramatically slowed down on their new foreclosures, because they didn't know how it was going to come out, and they were afraid of starting new foreclosures, and it was also because a lot of courts have started getting much tougher about foreclosures, and the judges were likely to throw them out. So for two reasons, the new foreclosures really slowed down, and the existing foreclosures started taking a lot more time, again because of more judicial scrutiny, but also because the banks make more money if they draw out the process. They can charge more fees, and they can continue to charge servicing. So even when the banks start foreclosures, which is what's usually reported in the paper, that doesn't mean that they move very as quickly as they could to actually eventually take the borrower's house. In fact, there are a lot of cases in Florida. There are Florida attorneys and investigators have been very active in documenting what's going on in that state. There are a lot of cases where the bank has actually won the foreclosure judgment, and yet they don't evict. They keep the person in the house because, again, they can still keep making more fees until they actually take the house. So we've got a huge amount of shadow inventory, and the estimates vary tremendously as to how much it is. But the one from the banking analyst that people find most credible, Lori Goodman, she says there are somewhere between 8 and 10 million homes in shadow inventory. And there's an analyst who writes on our site, and he comes with a number over 9 million. So there's a huge amount of houses that are still going to be coming on the market, and there's just no way housing prices are going to go up very strongly until all of that inventory is cleared. So at the very best, and I think this is overly optimistic, the very best is that housing prices will go sideways for a very, very long time. The idea that there's some bargain and you have to come into the market now is crazy. I mean, you could wait, even if you thought you had to buy a home. You can certainly wait and take your sweet time.
All right.
The second part, in terms of the influence of the banks, that's a bit more complicated. The reason that the banks are now so influential isn't simply their size. It's that they control the biggest 20 to 30 banks control the over-the-counter markets, which include the debt capital markets. We tend to think of financial markets as being like stock markets, but that's where you have a central exchange and the prices are all published, and the banks don't take the price risk. There's an exchange where different buyers and sellers meet, and the banks just submit the orders to the exchange. Whereas in the debt markets, the banks have inventory, and if you want to sell a bond, you don't go to exchange. You have to call a particular bank or a particular series of banks and get prices, and then decide which bank you're going to sell it to. And the bank takes that bond into inventory, they hope that they'll sell it to somebody else at a better price. The reason that the banks have become so powerful is that they control that buying and selling, and that as a matter of policy, since the 1980s, governments all around the world have moved from having banks make loans and keep them on their balance sheets the way they did in the past to having more and more loans be securitized. I described the processes for mortgages. They also do that for auto loans, for student loans, for credit cards. So all of the major debt categories are actually not kept on bank balance sheets. They're sold in the capital markets to investors. So that means that governments believe that all of the private credit creation really depends on these banks because they control, they're the middlemen in the debt markets, and if they were to get rid of the middlemen, that the whole system would seize up. And to some extent, that actually isn't untrue, that if you were to go and shoot the 15 biggest banks in the head, you'd have actually a problem, because if you were to have any kind of, and this is why I've been very critical of the Dodd-Frank Resolution Authority, that if you liquidate a bank, like you see what's happening now with MF Global, and they were a trading operation, and these banks are all now substantially trading operations, that there's a point where you have to stop the music and decide what everybody's position is worth and then settle up, and that takes time. And no investor wants to be in the position of having their positions frozen. So if they think some bank is going to be resolved, they'll take their money and run, which will cause a crash in all the prices to the assets that the banks are trading. That's what the authorities are afraid will happen. Now, that doesn't mean that the banks should be dealt with as kindly as they were dealt with. The idea that because the banks, you know, basically have a gun to the economy's head doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to disarm the bankers. And one of the things you pointed to is credit default swaps. One of the things that it's a very destructive product. It's basically unregulated insurance. And the way the product is set up, everybody's paying not enough for the insurance. And when you have a type of insurance which is where the premiums, the insurance payments, are too low, what you're going to have is that all the insurers will go bankrupt over time. That's what we saw with AIG. That's what we saw with the monoline insurers. Anybody who is a rider of credit default swap insurance over time is going to go bust. It may not happen immediately, but they're riding insurance premiums when they're not collecting enough to make good on the insurance promises. So the first thing that should have been done, I mean, there were steps that could have been done to make the banks less influential. You know, one of them would have been to have been much tougher with them in the bailouts, to have done what they did in Sweden when they resolve their banks, which is to fire management and fire the boards. This idea that these managers are so special and valuable is just crazy. You see how they get up in front of Congress and they know nothing. The senior managers of these banks do not know the mechanics of what's happening deep in the bowels of the organization. There are plenty of ex-senior bankers in the industry. The senior people at these banks are not irreplaceable. And being tough with them and forcing them to be, you know, and forcing them to make their balance sheet stronger before they paid bonuses, which would have forced pay down in the industry, would have made a huge difference. The second thing would have been to, over time, get rid of credit default swaps. You can't get rid of them quickly because they're all bound up in the positions of banks and the positions of investors, but you could have strangled them over time. That's a big reason why the banks are so interconnected, and getting rid of credit default swaps would have done a tremendous amount to make the system safer.
We're out of time for this segment. I appreciate your insight. I would offer that the credit default swap should be gotten rid of, because it's a insurance that if it hasn't actualized in on either side, then it's like someone coming in the room saying this crap game is over, and people take the money they have and put it in their pocket and walk away. I feel that we should reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act. I feel that we should not allow these people to do business the way they've been doing business, but they're going to continue to do that because they control the system, and that's unfortunate. Thank you very much, Eve Smith, for your insights.
Thank you.
And Eve Smith is the author of some very important work, including Econd, ECONNED, How Unenlightened Self-Interest Undermine Democracy and Corrupted Capitalism. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with Health and Nutrition. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Noll. Just one quick program announcement. I'm going to be having a premiere, but I think as of right now we're full. I'll find out by tomorrow if we're not. If we're not full for the premiere of my new feature documentary, which deals with our abandoned and forgotten vets, which will be March the 12th, 7:30, at Theater for New City at 1st Avenue between 8th and 9th and 10th Street. I'll give you the number, and if there's any seats, fine. If not, it's one showing only, 212-254-1109. It's free, 212-254-1109. Now, vitamin C, health and nutrition. Good news on this. This is about cancer. University of Otago, and what they found was that, quote, showering brain cancer cells with vitamin C softens them up for radiation therapy and hastens their death. This was a very important study. It showed that high-dose vitamin C with radiation affected the survival of cancer cells isolated from brain tumors and compared this with the survival of normal cells. They found that a high dose of vitamin C by itself caused the cancer cell to die. And this was published in Free Radical Biology and Medicine. So, that's good news. Eating fish may help ward off colon polyps in women. This is from Medical News Today from Vanderbilt University Medical Center, and it says, eating at least 3 servings of fish a week. By the way, if you're going to eat fish, I suggest sardines, because the FDA has now approved genetically modified salmon, but it's not labeled, so you wouldn't know that it's genetically modified. I don't think you want to be eating frankenfish, but sardines are your safest, healthiest fish. Anyhow, it says it will reduce a woman's risk of developing some types of colon polyps, and of course those can also develop into cancer, so it can help prevent cancer. 3 servings of fish a day. Now, when our body clock runs down, the immune system takes time off. Now, these are things I've been working with for a long time. This is from Yale School of Medicine and published in the journal Immunity. Here's what it says. The circadian clock is a finely tuned genetic mechanism that regulates our sleep cycles and key metabolic changes during a 24-hour cycle. It may help to determine whether you get sick or not. People intuitively know when their sleep patterns are disturbed, they're more likely to get sick. So what this is showing is when you're not getting the right type of sleep or good quality sleep, your immune system takes a big tumble. You bet. And that's why I emphasize, get that good night's sleep. It can make all the difference in the world, and that's what helps your immune system. Joining me in studio is Elizabeth, who's got the mailbag. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. Hello. I have an email here from a lady called Stephanie. I have another teacher. I have a lot of teachers that are
a lot of teachers
watching.
Listen, yeah.
Yes. She spent the afternoon yesterday Googling everything in radio. She reached back as far as she could because she can see this phenomenon has been occurring. You're quite absolutely correct that NPR, BBC, News, Fox and Pacifica, the conservative and liberal radio and the Tea Party and the Christian radio shows, about 30 titles in all, have all stayed relatively the same month after month, year after year. But she can track, where there was no one using the word progressive radio at all, at one point nobody, and now it's the fastest growing phenomena in radio. Now progressive radio occupies the top 3 positions today. If she doesn't know how many hits that represents, but certainly shows that your radio show is the number one driving force in the world when it comes to progressive themes. It's really growing, approaching 500 million, she's saying, and none of the others are.
Well, a correction. There's not 500 million people listening nor looking specifically for my show or the network. That's inaccurate. What it means is it's a search engine.
Right.
So when you put a word in, it's searching everything under that word, or 2 words or 3 words. But what it means is this, that historically when people were concerned about an issue or wanted information, maybe it was to read an article or listen to a radio program or look for a documentary, they would go to specific areas. Maybe it was NPR, maybe it was Pacifica, and they would type in, and then they would try to find which host, which programs, which websites under those search words gave you the information. So what is happening now is that a lot of people who are conservative but more libertarian a lot of people who are in the Green Movement and Constitutional Movement, the Patriot Movement, and the movements wanting more freedom, and those who have been in the liberal movement but are not comfortable aligning with the corporate Democrat liberals, they're looking for other sources. And this just happens to be one of the sources they're looking for. And so there, it's now approaching 500 million hits. But look at what it was 2 years ago. You know, it was tiny. It's growing because people are frustrated and they're wanting better sources of information. We just happen to be one of those sources. We're the top three positions, which means the dominant number of people are coming and getting that information from us.
Right.
But it does not mean that there's 500 million or close to it people listening to my show. We got a big audience, and it's growing. We see it every actual numbers on Google Analytical for our program every day. It's just growing by the thousands and thousands per day, every day. So that's good. What it's telling me is a lot of Americans are finally waking up to realizing that the information they have from their original sources is limiting, and they're wanting to expand that, and that's a good thing.
Yes. Yes, excellent. Okay, thank you very much. And someone from the audience, was it a Motown anniversary? This took place about 6 to 7 years ago in South Beach, and they could see that down at the very front there were the VIPs sitting there watching this wonderful concert, and there you were sitting with a very tall person, and what was very interesting, they said, is that more people were saying hello to you than they were to even big stars like Diana Ross. And Barry Gordy Jr. was on the stage, and he gave an address to you. And they were wondering, how did you wind up down there? And in front of everyone, they found it amazing because they knew who you were because they're from New York, but they didn't know everyone else did. And there was a huge audience for you.
No, they weren't. What it was is that afternoon I was having lunch there on South Beach, and this guy comes over and says, Gary, and I say, yeah, and he says, hey, he says, blah, 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 and says some nice words and say, there's a concert tonight, why don't you come? And I was just putting hurricane windows on a friend's apartment, and that was my buddy from West Virginia, tall guy, about 6'7", 6'8". So, and we didn't have any clothes. We had work clothes. So we said, okay. So I said, Tom, you want to go over there? He says, well, look how we dressed. I said, okay. So we went there, and he took us downstairs, down front, and it was a wonderful concert. And some of the people in there, I was counseling.
Wow.
And I didn't know it twice. They came out on stage, and I won't mention their names, but there's a lot of people. There's a lot of people who are into health in a lot of professions. And it was just nice afterwards that a lot of people came over and said hello. And it was just one big positive evening.
Right.
But it had nothing to do with me performing anything. And it was just, remember, at the end of the day, we're all just people, aren't we?
Right.
Whether you're well-known or not, we're just people.
Yeah.
Everyone. And so when you recognize people and you're kind to people, you know, people are kind in return.
Right.
You know, it's just that simple. That's why never take success seriously, ever.
Right.
All that success can ever do in life is give you an opportunity to have more that you can share with other people who are in need.
Yeah.
So it was a nice evening. Anyhow, we're running out of time. I want to thank everyone for listening. Have a whole lot going on. Maybe tomorrow I'll take a few moments and bring everyone up to date on all the projects that are currently in completion stage that you can expect to come your way. Investigative reports like on cancer, new documentaries, there's 7 right now that should be out in the next year, some new books, some new programs like going into the churches, getting a really good response from churches. In fact, right now I can't take on any more churches because there's just no more time. I mean, right now I'm going to be running every evening to a different church to help a whole congregation get on a health program. And so no more calls, because that was a tremendous outpouring of people who want to get their congregations healthy. which is a good thing, right?
Yes.
Get people out of diabetes and high blood pressure and heart disease and getting them living a healthier life and losing weight and helping them with their arthritis and pain and depression. So we're covering all of the different health conditions. And the whole congregation is doing it together. I'm absurd. There will be individuals who opt out, don't want to. That's fine. But as a group, it will happen. And the only request I have is if you find that this benefits you, if you really get healthier and better, then share this information. Pass it on. At the end of the day, more powerful than any major media is word of mouth. People sharing positive energy one to another. All right, so that's happening. So I'll bring it up. Don't forget, Friday's the big day when we're going to go into great depth, a whole hour on solar storms coming. You won't want to miss that. You won't hear that information anywhere else. So have a wonderful day, everyone.